Welcome back to the program. All this talk about the 1% versus the 99% did not happen overnight. For 30 years, the income gap in this country has grown geometrically. The middle class that once provided the center of American growth in the second half of the 20th century has shrunk. And even with globalization, the U.S. has seen economic inequality declining as compared to other Western nations. How did we get here? Was it serendipity, tax policy, partisan political action, or the inevitable result of the invisible hand of capitalism? We're going to do our best to try and understand this today with my guest, Timothy Noah. Tim Noah writes the TRB column for the New Republic. He contributes frequently to the CBS Sunday Morning program. He's made many appearances on NPR and received the 2011 Hillman Prize for Public Service Magazine Journalism. It is my pleasure to welcome Timothy Noah here to talk about the Great Divergence, America's growing inequality crisis, and what we can do about it. Timothy Noah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. To put it in terms, I suppose, to start, that people can really see, one of the things you point out is that basically if we take $100 over the past 30 years or so, that $80 of that wealth that was generated has gone to the 1%. Talk a little about that.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's we have seen two trends, actually, one of which involves the 1%, and that's the trend that we really didn't know about a decade ago, when two economists, Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, took a close look at tax records, and they found that the top 1% had doubled its share of the nation's income between 1979 and 2003. And so now we have this situation where there is an ever-expanding income share by the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and the top 0.01%. And this is superimposed on a separate but possibly related trend where you see a growing divide between skilled labor and unskilled labor.
One of the other aspects that you point out is that while the knee-jerk reaction sometimes might say that it has to do with immigration, it has to do with globalization, has to do with race and gender and a number of other issues, the fact of the matter is that if you look at all of those things, they are not the key contributing factors.
That's right. I mean, immigration has played a relatively small role in this story. We've only really been able to demonstrate that immigration has affected folks in a relatively small group, and that is high school dropouts. Otherwise, the rest of the population has been largely unaffected by the increase in immigration. And when we talk about the Great Divergence, we are really talking about a divide not so much between the poor and the middle class. The relationship of incomes between the poor and the middle class hasn't changed all that much since 1979. The big change is between the middle class and the affluent. There we don't see much impact of immigration. Trade is a more complicated story, but for most of the last 30 years, trade had a fairly minimal impact, simply because the United States was not trading very much with countries that had significantly lower wage scales. That began to change in the 1990s with the rise of trade with China, which manages paradoxically to be a rich industrializing country and also a very poor country in terms of wages. And that, of course, is a function in large part of the fact that it's got a billion people. So trade has not been nearly as significant as many people might think, although it has become significant in the last decade or so.
What are we seeing in terms of the relationship between economic growth overall and inequality?
Well, there are a number of people who think that inequality is a prerequisite to economic growth, and you know, that is true in a very, very limited sense. That, of course, in a capitalist system, you have to have some inequality in order to reward skill and effort, and the argument is really about how much you need. During the period from about 1934 to 1979, the United States saw quite a lot of economic growth, particularly after, well, not so much during the Great Depression, of course, or World War II, but after World War II, we had some of the biggest income, some of the biggest economic growth that we've seen in our history. And yet, during that entire time, incomes were becoming more equal. They became more equal under the Depression. They became more equal during World War II. Maybe that wasn't a surprise, but then they continued to become more equal and then remain relatively stable for a long time after World War II, really until 1979. So there are some people who say that far from impeding economic growth, that growing income equality actually assists economic growth. Workers feel like they have a stake in prosperity, and of course they're able to purchase goods, which helps the economy going.
What about productivity and the productivity gains that we have seen at the same time we've seen this inequality gap grow?
Well, that's one of the most shocking facts of recent economic life, is that, for a long time, the median income was stagnating for a long time relative to median income in the post-war years, and also relative to incomes at the top. And for a long time, economists said, don't worry, the problem is productivity isn't quite high enough. When you see a real increase in productivity, particularly a payoff from computerization, then you'll see incomes rise a lot. And what's really shocking is that productivity did finally rise quite a bit. It actually rose. It's been rising since the 80s, but it rose at an especially steep rate in the aughts. And yet, during that decade, the first decade of the 21st century, we saw median income actually decline slightly. So workers really don't seem to have much of a stake in prosperity other than fear of losing their jobs in an economic downturn. There's no positive incentive because they're not sharing in prosperity when prosperity occurs. We're in the middle of an economic recovery right now, and Emmanuel Saez of Berkeley did a study in March of this year, too late to be included in my book, where he looked at the situation of the 1% during the economic recovery. The 1%, of course, lost a great deal of income during the recession. Rich people tend to get hit hard by recessions. But they their income share was rising again as of 2010, the first year of the economic recovery. Remarkably, though, nobody else's income was rising. 93% of the recovery ended up in the pockets of the 1%. I find that a shocking statistic.
The other thing that parallels that, which is remarkable, is the lack of the declining economic mobility, particularly with respect to ways in which we lag even other Western European nations.
That's right. A lot of people say, oh, who needs to worry about income inequality if you've got social mobility in the United States that's the envy of the world? Even I thought that when I started out on my series. I happen to think income inequality matters no matter what the level of mobility is, because some people are going to be left behind. But nonetheless, I was ready to concede the argument that the United States had remarkable upward mobility. But it turns out the United States no longer has remarkable mobility compared to comparable nations. In fact, the United States lags most of Western Europe, according to most studies. Italy and the United Kingdom, I think, are the only countries you can place behind us when it comes to economic mobility. So that's troublesome. People have this self-image in the United States that we are an extremely mobile nation. In fact, polls show that we in the United States believe there is much greater mobility, opportunity in our society than do people in other countries where mobility is actually higher. It's very ironic.
And that irony, that fact, seems to lie in some ways at the nucleus of this whole discussion, this kind of sense of aspiration that people have, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary.
That's right. Well, there's an old saying that says there are two kinds of people in the United States, the people who are rich and people who intend to get rich. And I think that is true to some extent. But, we get our ideas about upward mobility principally from two writers. One is Horatio Alger, who I think everybody has heard of. The other is James T. Adams, who most people haven't heard of, but they've heard of the phrase that he invented, which was the American dream. Mm-hmm. Both of them lived during a period, that is the late 19th and early 20th century, when mobility in the United States really was the envy of the world. The U.S. economy was industrializing rapidly. You saw a big run-up in income inequality, but you also saw a huge run-up in income mobility. And so that at that time in history, you really could say that income inequality was the price you paid for growing income mobility. That hasn't been true for a very long time.
What happened in 1979 that started to change all of this?
Well, the initial occurrence was really 1973, when you saw the Arab oil embargo, and you saw economic stagnation begin in the United States. And that was really income stagnation for everybody. Then, in the late 1970s, you saw incomes start to go up for those who were affluent or super rich, and yet incomes did not go up in the middle. And you had a number of causes for that, I think. One was that starting in the 1970s, the high school graduation rate, which had risen and risen and risen through the 20th century, stopped rising. And as the American economy became more sophisticated, as technology became more sophisticated, the demand for skilled workers, educated workers, had been growing through the 20th century. And until the 70s, the supply of skilled workers had always been able to rise to meet that demand. That stopped being true in the 1970s. You also saw the beginning of a pretty rapid decline for the labor movement in the United States. I think that had a profound effect. And you also saw deregulation on Wall Street through the 1980s in particular, and through the 90s as well. And that had a huge impact on the top 1%.
What role has education played in this?
Well, as I say, we've seen the supply of educated workers has not risen to meet demand. When you look at K through 12, that's bid up the price of educated workers. And also when you look at college, college has become very expensive. We've seen fantastic increase in tuition and fees for undergraduates. And so college is basically beginning to price itself out of the market for those of moderate incomes. And that, too, has limited the supply of skilled labor. It's made it more difficult both in terms of mobility, and it's also contributed to economic inequality.
There are those that say, and you talk about this in the Great Divergence, that there is a certain inevitability to this. Address that.
Well, to some extent, in my book, I began with the assumption that, yes, income inequality is a worldwide trend. But there are two significant caveats to that. One is that it's not a universal trend in advanced industrial democracies. In France, incomes were growing more equal until fairly recently, and they've become a little more unequal lately, but the overall trend for the last 30 years is basically stable. That's true for a few other European countries, too. So there has been a tendency towards greater income inequality, driven by a number of global trends, but it hasn't been universal. That's one. Number two is that it has been much worse in the United States. So what I tried to do in my book was say, okay, I understand that some of these forces are global in nature, but that doesn't explain why it's so much worse in the United States. So I tried to look at the factors that had made income inequality increase much faster in the United States and that made income inequality occur at a much higher rate in the United States.
When we look at places like Finland and other Scandinavian countries where we don't see that degree of income inequality, what do we understand then?
Well, there are differences between those countries and the United States. There is a more extensive social welfare net. You tend to have much healthier union infrastructure in those countries. You've seen unions decline in their power worldwide, again, because of globalization. But nowhere have you seen labor unions decline anywhere near to the extent that they have in the United States. I mean, in the United States, we are now down to a unionized workforce of about 7% in the private workforce. And that takes us back to 1932. You know, there's one sentence I was tempted to write several times in the book, but I did write it at this point in the book, and that is, it's as if the New Deal never happened.
And with unions, it's interesting because I think you quote Chamber of Commerce at some point, you know, going back to mid-20th century, saying, or even earlier, that unions were kind of inevitable and certainly not the story today.
That's right. You know, at mid-century, the capitalists pretty much accepted the existence of, maybe even the need for, strong labor. And there was an agreement reached in between the United Auto Workers, led by Walter Reuther, and the major auto companies that established that workers would receive raises in step with productivity increases over multiple years. It created a certain amount of predictability that the capitalists like, and it also created a certain amount of income security for labor. That began to break down as competitive, worldwide competitive pressures started to be felt in the 1970s. But again, it was the impact in the United States was much worse than in other countries. And as a consequence, we have seen much greater income inequality.
To what extent has public policy in general and tax policy specifically impacted this?
Well, tax policy, interestingly, has not had as much impact as you might suspect. And the reason I say that is that, you know, when we look at the changes in tax policy over the last 30 years, they have been pretty spectacular. When Ronald Reagan was elected president, the top marginal tax rate for high incomes was 70%. It is now 35%. That's a pretty steep drop. However, what also happened, starting with Reagan and through the Clinton years, was that we saw lower income people also see their tax rates go down. Many of those people were removed from the income tax altogether, although, of course, they were still paying payroll tax. And as a consequence, the income tax is actually slightly more progressive today than it was in 1979. Now, when you look at the totality of all federal taxes plus federal transfer payments, benefit programs, then you see that the federal government, its redistributive function is about 25% less pronounced. That is, there's 25% less income redistribution today than there was in 1979. So that's not insignificant. But the real trend in income inequality has to do with incomes before you even look at taxes and transfers. And that is influenced in many ways by other kinds of government policies, including Fed policies, how much inflation we have, a number of other factors that are, I think, poorly understood at the moment. But the way we know that's happening is there's a very strong correlation between the partisan affiliation of the president at any given time and equality or inequality trends while that president is in the White House. Larry Bartels, a political scientist at Vanderbilt, looked at White House looked at the presidency back to 1948, and he found that under Republican presidents, the greatest income gains consistently went to those at the top and tapered off as he went down the income scale. Exact opposite for Democrats. The biggest income gains went to those at the bottom and tapered off as he went up the income scale. And interestingly, there was more economic growth under the Democrats than under the Republicans. Where the distinction starts to break down is when you get above the top 5% in income. Then you start to see less partisan difference. So when you're talking about incomes at the very top, very rich people seem to do extremely well under both Democrats and Republicans.
Given all of this, then, where do we begin to look for ways in which to right the proverbial ship?
Well, I think there are a number of things that can be done, and sadly, very few of them are likely to occur tomorrow. they're not wildly popular. but some of them have been discussed by President Obama. One I think that has a decent chance of happening is we do need to raise taxes on top incomes. The income tax didn't cause this problem, but it could help a bit. So I think we need to lay in some new marginal rates, not just for incomes over $250,000, as President Obama has suggested, but also for incomes over $1 million and $10 million. As we see greater income concentration at the top, I think that our tax policy needs to follow that reality and make these distinctions that maybe weren't so necessary before. So that's one thing. Another solution is I think we need to universalize preschool. If our education system is failing to produce enough high school graduates and ultimately college and grad school educated people, then one good place to help would be to increase access to early education, which research has shown is so very important. And President Obama campaigned on this in 2008. I actually don't find this to be a hugely unrealistic political goal, and I think it's something that we should be talking about more. One idea that I had that I thought was really kind of out there and radical when I proposed in my book was later actually mentioned by President Obama in the State of the Union address after my book went to the publishers, and that is, I call it price controls on college tuition. President Obama didn't put it quite so bluntly, but in the State of the Union, he put colleges and universities on notice that if they couldn't get increases in tuition and fees under control, the United States would use its leverage through federal grants to put some downward pressure on. We need to revive the labor movement. That's one of the more difficult challenges, but I think we won't see much improvement in income equality until that happens. We need to re-regulate Wall Street. That's probably familiar to a lot of your listeners. It's a number of people have said that the 2008 crash was brought about because Wall Street was operating in a unregulated environment where profits were privatized and losses were collectivized. We need to see an end to that. We need to break up the big banks, I think. We need to get a choke chain on non-financial corporations when it comes to CEO pay, which has been spinning wildly out of control in recent years. So those are some of the things I think we need to do.
What are the consequences, as you see it, if we do very little, if nothing?
Well, I think that we can't really afford to have the United States become an ever more unequal nation when it comes to income. A number of people say, well, the only thing that matters is social equality, legal equality. Everybody should get to vote. Everybody should have equal access to education and the courts and so on. And, I think that that's true. We've seen great increases in the last couple of generations when it comes to equality for African Americans, for women, for gays, and so on. But we also need to see we can't afford to have greater income inequality at the same time, because that really drives a stake, I think, through the idea of e pluribus unum. We will be a less unified country. Already, I think you see a kind of tribalistic hostility between people at middle incomes and the affluent. Interestingly enough, this is documented extensively by a very conservative writer, Charles Murray, mm-hmm. in his recent book, Coming Apart. Mm-hmm. He resists the idea that this is driven by income inequality, which I find a little perverse, but he documents pretty vividly how you are seeing people at middle incomes and people who are affluent become sort of mutually alien. And I think that's very costly to democracy. I also think it's costly to the economy. Again, I think that when the average working person doesn't have much of a stake in America's prosperity, he's not going to work as hard. He's not going to help create that prosperity.
Do you anticipate that we will be able to have, if not a full-throated, at least a mild debate about these issues in the context of the coming election?
Well, we already have the president talking about it, which I think is great. I think to an unprecedented degree, the election is already about income inequality. You also have the Council of Economic Advisers doing some very interesting work in recent months, tracking the relationship between income inequality and a decline in income mobility. It's somewhat tentative, but Alan Krueger, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, has traced what he calls the Great Gatsby effect, which is that as income inequality rises, it becomes harder to for people to be mobile. Isabel Sawhill of the Brookings Institution has put it this way. She says, as the rungs of the ladder grow farther apart, the ladder gets harder to climb.
Timothy Noah, the book is The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. It is just out from Bloomsbury. Timothy, I thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.